I start with a brief reminder. Remember, the set lambda of m is the differential, is the space of differential forms. It is in fact an associative algebra. It is called the Grassmann algebra over the manifold m. It is an algebra with respect to the multiplication that we called the wedge product. The wedge product takes S forms and multiplies them with R forms to obtain S plus R forms. For example, the product of 2 1 forms will give you a 2 form. We also introduced the exterior derivative. The exterior derivative mapped differential forms into differential forms, or differential form fields into differential form fields. I will just speak of differential forms when I mean differential form fields. The exterior derivative is an antiderivation. Remember, that means the Leibniz rule occasionally has a minus sign. It depends on whether the first of the 2 forms that we want to differentiate has an odd or even degree. If it has an odd degree, then we have a minus sign there. The exterior derivative is an antiderivation, and it is of degree k equal to 1. This means that the exterior derivative will turn an R form into an R plus 1 form. Now, what we have not defined so far is a directional derivative. Now, you may say, wait a moment, we did that, right? Tangent vectors are directional derivatives. Yes, they directionally differentiate functions. But what is the directional derivative of an R form, of a 2 form, a 3 form, a 1 form? We haven't defined that yet. Now, clearly, the special case where we directionally differentiate a function should be the case that we already covered, tangent vectors. But what is the directional derivative of general differential forms? And in complete generality, what's the directional derivative of tensors in general? This notion is going to be very important, directional derivative. It's of particular importance when we will later, in the context of general relativity, we'll talk about conservation laws. Because if you remember from Noether's theorem, the fact that the laws of nature don't change in the time direction translates into the conservation of energy. The fact that the laws of nature don't change in spatial directions translates into conservation of momentum. The fact that they don't change under rotations means the conservation of angular momentum. And there are more laws like that. It turns out that in general relativity, space-time itself may have non-trivial features in spatial and time directions when we do have translation invariance in a time direction or in a space direction, then we will have conservation laws. But in general, time and energy and angular momentum are not conserved in general relativity. Now, to study all those things, we need directional derivatives on all sorts of objects, not just functions, but also differential forms and tensors. So here's the plan. We try to modify or to work with the exterior derivative that we already have and turn it into a directional derivative, right? We have the D operator, this co-boundary thing, the D. It differentiates, all right? It's just not specific to directions yet. We want to make something that's direction specific. Now, the exterior derivative, remember, was an antiderivation. The directional derivative really should be derivation rather than antiderivation, right? We don't want to have any extra minus signs in there. Also, it is of degree k equal plus 1, which we don't want a directional derivative to have. The directional derivative of a function is a function. So it maps 0 forms into 0 forms. The directional derivative of an R form ought to be an R form again. So we are looking for a directional derivative which is such that it is of degree equals 0. So our exterior derivative seems to be all wrong. It's antiderivation, and it increases the degree of the differential form. Well, the trick is to undo that, to introduce another derivation which lowers the degree by 1, and is also an antiderivation. When we combine the two, we get a regular derivation that's going to be the directional derivative. That's one way to do it. We will do it this way, and we will do it another way too, just to make sure we see it from all directions, what it is. So here we introduce the so-called inner derivation, and it will be useful to turn the exterior derivative into a directional derivative, because the inner derivation is going to be also an antiderivation. When combined with the exterior derivative, we will get a derivation. Also, it is of degree k equal minus 1. It lowers the degree of a differential form. When combined with the exterior derivative, that will just keep the degree the same as we want it to be for a directional derivative. And it will have a direction dependence. So the plan is to define, first of all, the inner derivation, and then combine the exterior derivation, d, and the inner derivation, which has a direction dependence, xi. Xi is some vector field that points in the direction in which we want to differentiate. And then we combine the two to obtain a derivation of degree k equals 0, which is then called the Lie derivative. We'll do all of this abstractly without having to refer to any coordinate system. And this way, we make sure that the definition is generally covariant. If we did it in a coordinate system, we would have to prove that first changing coordinate system and then making the definition, or first making the definition and then changing coordinate system gives us the same result. But doing it abstractly relieves us from that duty. Okay, so here's going to be the inner derivation. It's going to have a direction dependent. So let's say xi is some tangent vector field. It specifies in which direction we want to differentiate. Of course, this tangent vector field can point in different places in different directions. We can at once differentiate in this direction, that direction. You know, we can differentiate in this direction over here, differentiate in that direction over there. Completely up to us. We specify how we directionally differentiate by choosing the tangent vector xi. Now, we define the antiderivation I index xi. So the inner derivation I index xi, that is to say, inner direction of xi, as an antiderivation of degree k equal minus 1, as the following linear map. It will map differential S forms into differential S minus 1 forms. And in particular, it will map 0 forms into nothing, into just 0. And how does it do it? Well, the inner derivation will map some differential form, differential S form, into what we will call I index xi of omega. Now remember that there is this nice property of abstract definitions of derivations. Once we define how a derivation acts on functions, and we define how it acts on one forms or on a basis of one forms, then we automatically specified how it acts on all differential forms, because we know that it obeys the antiderivation Leibniz rule. And therefore, we can now combine everything to get arbitrarily large forms. If we know how a derivation or antiderivation acts on zero forms and one forms, we can always combine one forms to get R forms and apply the derivation, the Leibniz rule to that, and can work out what the action of the antiderivative is. So in order to define what the inner derivation is, we only have to say how it acts on zero forms and how it acts on one forms. Okay, it's supposed to be an anti-derivation, which means that it obeys the anti-Leibniz rule. The antiderivation applied to the wedge product of two differential forms has to be the antiderivation applied to the first factor, leaving the second one alone, plus or minus, leaving the first factor alone, and then wedge the antiderivation applied to the second one. And remember, it's a general rule for anti-Leibniz rules that there is a minus sign if R is odd. R is the degree of the first form in here. Okay, so now we define what it is on zero forms. Our inner derivation maps zero forms into zero, because there are no minus one forms. And it's supposed to map one forms into zero forms. It's supposed to map cotangent vectors into functions, because it's supposed to be an antiderivation of degree minus one. It's supposed to lower that index over here. So how do we define that to work? Well, we define the inner derivation, inner direction psi, of a one form, that is to say, cotangent vector omega, to be whatever comes out when you apply the cotangent vector on the tangent vector. Very simple. Okay, so basically the inner derivation of a one form consists of plugging the vector into the one form. You get a function out of this, right? Because this is actually the same as psi applied to omega, which is the directional derivative of omega, which is in coordinates in the chart, simply the sum over the omega I psi I. And this simple definition here, because it says what the inner derivation does on functions and what it does on one forms, already completely specifies what the inner derivation does on all differential forms, simply because we can combine one forms to get R forms through wedge products, and we know how the inner derivation acts when it encounters wedge products, namely because of the Leibniz rule. Okay, so the inner derivation is already fully defined. So here's a proposition. Assume that gamma is an S form, and Ixi gamma is therefore an S minus 1 form. And what is that S minus 1 form? Well, it's going to, since it is an S minus 1 form, it's going to be hungry for S minus 1 tangent vectors. Right? You feed S minus 1 tangent vectors into an S minus 1 form to get out a function. So Ixi gamma is an S minus 1 form, because gamma is an S form, Ixi gamma is a degree lower, is an S minus 1 form. We can feed it S minus 1 tangent vector field. And the outcome of that is supposed to be a function, a zero form. And what zero form is it supposed to be? Well, it's what you get when you take gamma, your S form, and plug in all those S minus 1 tangent vectors, and plug in as the first argument the psi, the direction of the inner derivation. So this completely generalizes what we had earlier, right? We said that the inner derivation acts on a one form by feeding the one form the psi as its argument. Now, if this is not a one form but an S form, then what this thing does is it feeds the argument as, it feeds psi as the first argument of that S form, right? So it's really a very simple thing. Gamma is an S form, and Ixi gamma is the same S form, but the first argument is already occupied with psi. That's what it says. The first argument is psi automatically, and the remaining S minus 1 slots are telling us that we're dealing with an S minus 1 form. So for example, let's say gamma is a 2 form. And let's say it's a particular 2 form. It's simply the wedge product of 2 1 forms, omega and nu. Then what is the inner derivation of gamma in the direction of psi? It's going to be a 1 form. Let's apply the Leibniz rule. So the inner derivation of gamma, inner derivation therefore of omega wedge nu, is by the Leibniz rule, or by the anti-Leibniz rule, what we get when we apply the inner derivation on the first argument, leaving the second one alone, plus or minus. In fact, in this case, it is a minus, because omega is one form, degree is odd, minus 1 to the power 1, it's a minus. So minus, leaving the first factor alone, veg, whatever we get when we apply the inner derivation on the second factor. So this is to say that this is omega of psi, because the inner derivation, inner direction of psi of omega is the evaluation of omega on psi, or psi on omega, that's this, which is a function times nu, That's why I was able to drop the veg here, because this is a zero form, just a function, minus, and then we have the omega, and I xi nu, this is simply xi of nu or nu of xi, same thing. And again, we could have put a wedge in here or over there and multiply this here, but you know, this is a zero form. You can write it to the left or to the right of differential forms, whichever way you want. So now, let's take that derivative, let's take that inner derivation of gamma, this thing here, which is a one form. Is it really one form? Let's see, this is a one form, that is a one form, and these are zero form. So the whole thing is a one form. Let's apply that, and let's use this thing, this one form, and apply it to a tangent vector to get a function. Okay, so we plug this tangent vector in here. I mean, into all of this, which is a one form. What is that? Well, okay, so here, this is the thing. This is the ixi gamma, and we feed it now the eta. So we feed it here, because this is a hungry one form, and that's a hungry one form. Okay, so this feeds on the xi, that feeds on the xi, and overall we get this expression. So this is the outcome of the inner derivation of gamma, in the direction of xi, applied to a vector field eta. And that's a function here. Let us compare that with the claim of the proposition. Remember, the proposition's claim was that the inner derivation in the direction of xi has a very trivial action. You simply take the xi and feed it as the first argument to the differential form. Let me just show you that again. The claim is that if you have a differential form gamma, differential S form gamma, then it has S open slots. If you want to differentiate it in with respect to the inner derivation in the direction of xi, all you do is you use up the first slot with xi, and you're left with an S minus one form. It's antisymmetric in all of the remaining arguments, so it's still a form. So let's quickly check whether that is the same. So we calculated what the inner derivation of the two-form gamma is when applied to eta, and that was the result. And now let's check whether that's the same as what the proposition claims. The proposition claims that the inner derivation of gamma in the direction xi applied to eta, so the inner derivation of omega veg nu applied to eta, so the inner derivation of what omega veg nu is when spelled out in tensor product, namely that, applied to eta. So according to the proposition, all we have to do is we have to plug in the xi as the first argument and the eta as the second argument. And if we do that, if we plug the xi into the first slot, namely here omega of xi and here nu of xi, and the eta on the second slot, nu of eta and omega of eta, we get this, which agrees with that. So that's not a proof for the general case, but it shows you that it works in this case. And you can convince yourself, if you have spare time, that this is always the case. So what are the properties of this inner derivation? The inner derivation, when you concatenate it with itself, so you do the inner derivation in the xi2 direction, and then in the direction of another vector field xi1. So these are not components of one vector field. These are two different vector fields. Xi1 and xi2 are two different vector fields. If you do the inner derivation in the direction of a vector field xi2, followed by the inner derivation of some differential form in the direction of xi1, then this is actually antisymmetric. That's easy to see from the proposition above, because this means, to carry that out means, you plug psi 2 as the first argument into the differential form, and then you plug psi 1 as the second argument in the differential form. And here you do it the other way around, but that's antisymmetric. The arguments of a differential form are antisymmetric. That's why you get a minus sign. This means in particular, that if you calculate the inner derivation twice in the same direction, for the same direction vector field, then you get zero. Which is a bit similar to the fact that the exterior derivative applied twice also gives us zero. Now remember, when psi is a vector field, and gamma, if psi is a tangent vector and gamma is a dual tangent vector, it's a cotangent vector, then the inner derivation of gamma in the direction of psi, as we had earlier, is the evaluation of gamma on psi, which is the same as psi applied to gamma. Right? Whether you apply a tangent vector on a cotangent vector or cotangent vector on a tangent vector is really the same thing. A matter of terminology. The inner derivation that you obtain for a cotangent vector in this way, so the inner derivation of a cotangent vector in the direction of a tangent vector, is also called the interior product of psi and gamma, because it's like psi of gamma or it's gamma of psi. It looks a bit like an interior, like an inner product in a vector space, but it is not. It is an interior product because this is not an inner product. If you remember from linear algebra, in order to have an inner product, you actually need something like a metric. You need a symmetric tensor to define that. We haven't done that yet. So this is not an inner product. We call it an interior product. It's simply the evaluation of a cotangent vector on a tangent vector. So now finally we are ready to define the Lie derivative. Remember, the strategy was to define the inner derivation, which has sort of opposite properties to the exterior derivation. Exterior derivation raises the degree of a differential form by one, and it's an antiderivation. The inner derivation lowers the degree of a differential form, and it's also an antiderivation. Let's see what happens when we combine the two of them. Let's remember what they do again. I'm just going through what is on the slides for completeness. The exterior derivation maps S forms into S plus 1 forms. And it's really the generalization of the notion of differential. Remember, a differential maps functions into their differentials, which are cotangent vectors. And the exterior, first we had the D for that purpose. And then we said, but the D can actually act on all differential forms. So it's a generalization of the D that just maps functions into differentials. The inner derivation is also a generalization of something that we knew earlier. Namely, the inner derivation is a map that maps S forms into S minus 1 forms. And it generalizes the notion of evaluation of vectors against covectors. So if you take a one form, you can feed it a direction vector, that is to say a tangent vector, you get a function out of it. It gets evaluated against it. And now, what happens if we take an arbitrary S form and we feed it a tangent vector as its first argument? Well, now we know what it is. It's the inner derivation. So if you take an S form and you evaluate it against the tangent vector field, you feed it the tangent vector field as its first argument, you get an S minus 1 form. That's the inner derivation. We also had the notion that vector fields can be viewed as performing directional derivatives, but only on functions. They mapped functions into functions through directional derivatives. Now we can generalize that to all differential forms. As we said before, we want the directional derivative to be a derivation, not an antiderivation. No funny minus sign. So we want the directional derivative, which we will call L subscript psi, so the directional derivative in the direction of psi. It will be called the Lie derivative. We want the directional derivative in the direction of psi of the wedge product of two differential forms to be given by the directional derivative applied to omega, leaving the second factor the same and vice versa. And it should map, as we said, R forms into R forms, which is to say that it should be of degree k equals 0. And the directional derivative should do on functions what vector fields do on functions, namely directional differentiate. So if we take a function on the manifold, a zero form, then the directional derivative, the Lie derivative in a direction psi, should map functions into functions by mapping the function into the action of the vector field on F. So that the Lie derivative, the full directional derivative, reduces to the ordinary directional derivative for functions. Which, just to remind you, psi of F is this, right? Psi is a linear combination, these are the linear combination factors, of the partial derivatives. This is a direction vector. This is a space-dependent, you know, position-dependent direction vector. And that's applied to f of x. And the outcome of that is a function again, function of x. So how can we define now the Lie derivative on arbitrary differential forms? Well, remember, we only have to define it on zero forms, which we just did by saying that it's just the same as what the vector field does. And we have to define what it does on a basis of one form. And then, by virtue of it being a derivation, we have already automatically defined how the Lie derivative acts on all differential forms. So we have to define how the Lie derivative acts on one form, because we know how the Lie derivative acts on zero form. It simply does the usual vector field direction derivative. On one forms, we define it in the following way. We choose as a basis of one forms, for example, the dxi. But it doesn't really matter what basis we choose. Then it is natural to define the directional derivative of a gradient field. And remember, these guys are gradient fields. Any one form which is the D of a function is a gradient field. And we can always choose a basis made out of gradient fields, namely these guys. They are all gradient fields because the xi is a coordinate function. Remember, xi is a scalar function. It's the function that maps points of the manifold into real numbers, namely the i's coordinate. Okay, and the dxi is a gradient vector field. It's a cotangent vector. So it is natural to define the directional derivative of a gradient field of a function to be the gradient of the directional derivative. So whether we first form the gradient or then form the directional derivative shouldn't matter. Shouldn't matter which way around we do it. So we define the Lie derivative, that is the directional derivative in a direction psi, to be the following map from one forms into one forms. It's supposed to map one forms df into that one form which we obtain when we take psi, the direction in which we want to differentiate, apply that to the function f, to obtain a function, right? And then take the exterior derivative of that to obtain a one form. Okay, so the general idea is that we're dealing with two kinds of derivatives, gradient and directional derivative, and they should commute. So the Lie derivative, the directional derivative of the exterior derivative, is by definition the exterior derivative of the directional derivative. Right? Xi on f is the directional derivative in the direction of xi of the function f. So it's the directional derivative, and then we apply the exterior derivative. Here we take the function f, we apply the exterior derivative, and then the directional derivative. So the left-hand side is defined through the right-hand side here. So So the gradient of a directional derivative is the directional derivative of the gradient. Now we have defined the Lie derivative on all differential forms implicitly, because we now know how the Lie derivative L xi acts on zero forms, how it acts on one form. If you're now given any basis of the space of S forms in terms of one forms, wedge products of one forms, then using the Lie derivative, using the Leibniz rule, you can work out how it acts on all S forms. So we defined L xi in this way. How is it related to the two derivations D that we had earlier and the inner derivation that, that we defined at the beginning of this lecture? The relationship between the full directional derivative on differential forms and the exterior and the inner derivation is this one, which is called Cartan's equation. I leave it up to you to prove that this combination, first inner, then exterior derivation, plus first exterior, then inner derivation, that this combination is really a derivation. So you just have to check that it obeys the Leibniz rule for that purpose. It's pretty clear that it's going to be a derivation of, if it is a derivation, which it is, it's pretty clear that it's going to be one of degree zero, because that raises the degree of a differential form, and that lowers it by one. This lowers it by one, that raises it by one. Okay. So let's see. Let's see whether that definition here, let's prove this by making use of our definition of the Lie derivative. We defined it by having it act on zero forms and having it act on one form. Now let's prove that this matches that definition here. Let us apply the Lie derivative so defined on zero forms and check whether we get what we defined earlier. Okay, so we have the Lie derivative act on a zero form. According to that definition, we have to apply D after I xi on the zero form plus the inner after the exterior derivation on the zero form. Now, the first term doesn't contribute anything because it's a zero form to start with. The inner derivation on zero form should give us a minus one form. There's no such thing. We map onto zero in this case. That was part of the definition earlier. So there's no contribution from this part. Here we have the differential of the function, and then we apply the inner derivation to it, which is to say we evaluate that one form against that tangent vector, that cotangent vector against that tangent vector. So it is df applied to xi, which is by definition xi applied to f. And that is how we defined the directional derivative in the direction of xi to act on functions. Xi is the directional derivative that acts on functions. This is how we defined it earlier. Okay, so the Cartan's formula agrees with what we defined earlier. Now, let us act with the so defined Lie derivative on a basis of one form to see whether we get the same as what we defined earlier. So the Lie derivative acts on some gradient vector field df. It could be the dxi's if you want. The point is that you can have a basis made out of gradient vector fields. So let's act with the Lie derivative, the directional derivative on the df. According to Cartan's formula, we have to evaluate it this way. And now we see that the second term in Cartan's formula drops out because we have a d, this one, applied to the df. From here, that's a d squared, that's zero. And what does the first term give us? Well, here we have the inner derivation in the direction of xi of df, which is a cotangent vector applied on a tangent vector. It's df of xi, which is xi of f. And then there's a d outside after that. So it's a xi of f, and outside it's a d. That's exactly how we defined it earlier too. The Lie derivative of an exterior derivative is the exterior derivative of the Lie derivative. Right? So the directional derivative of an exterior derivative is the exterior derivative of the external of the directional derivative. So we have that Cartan's formula agrees on zero forms and on one forms. If we can also prove that it's a derivation of degree k equals zero, then we are done. And we have seen that this formula describes the same Lie derivative. I leave it up to you to check that it's really derivation, that it is of degree k equals zero is trivial. To see that it's a derivation is also not hard. Now, let's define commutators. Doesn't mean that we start quantum mechanics now, unfortunately. Commutators. For any two linear maps, A, which map differential forms into differential forms, so A and B both map differential forms into differential forms, we define their commutator. It is also sometimes called their Lie bracket or also their Poisson bracket. That's because commutators obey the axioms of a Lie bracket, and when they occur in an associative algebra, then the whole construction, the associative algebra, together with the Lie algebra structure, is called the Poisson bracket. Doesn't matter here. I'm just mentioning it for completeness. Okay, so the commutator between two such maps is B followed by A, and B and A followed by B. So this is not a multiplication, this is a concatenation. This is one of those little circles. First apply that map, and then apply this map. So for example, we have that the exterior derivation is clearly a map from differential forms into differential forms. So is the inner derivation, so is the Lie derivative. They're all mapping differential forms into differential forms, and we can therefore consider their commutators. And there is a lot of opportunity for homework there if you if you're looking for stuff to prove. So for those three derivations, one can prove that the Lie derivative commutes with the exterior derivative. Remember, that was part of the definition, nothing to prove here. Right? We said that the Lie derivative of the exterior derivative is the exterior derivative of the Lie derivative. Okay, that's zero. Interestingly, we also have that the Lie derivative that the commutator of two Lie derivatives is itself a Lie derivative again. That is not trivial, because the Lie derivative is a first derivative, right? It's a first derivative. It's a derivative in a particular direction. It's a directional derivative. And that's another directional derivative. The commutator consists, naively thinking, of a second derivative minus a second derivative, right? Because you differentiate once, you differentiate again, minus the other way around. So it would seem that the commutator is the second derivative. But no, it turns out to be a first derivative, a Lie derivative. A Lie derivative is always a first derivative. In coordinates, as we will see, it's a first derivative. How come that the commutator of two first derivatives is a first derivative, not a second derivative? It turns out that the second derivative terms occur, but drop out. And there will be some mixed terms that arise that are first derivative type. And those are the guys that survive over here. The reason is that the Lie derivative, you can think of in special cases as something like partial derivatives. Partial derivatives commute. So you would expect that the commutator of two Lie derivatives has to be zero. But remember that vector fields, which are really partial derivatives decorated, they're linear combinations of partial derivatives, right? But vector fields are linear combinations of partial derivatives with coefficients that are themselves functions. So when you calculate the commutator, as we will do in a moment, you will see, I'm just anticipating what comes next, you will see that when you work out the commutator, you have derivatives acting on coefficient functions too. And in this way, you can have single derivatives survive. And it turns out that all the second derivatives always drop out, and you're just left with first derivatives, and that's what this formula is expressing here. Yes, and what is this here? We have the commutator of two vector fields. What's a commutator between two vector fields? Well, a vector field maps functions into functions, right? So you can do, actually, one of those hooks there should be a comma. Well, it's just missing. There should be a comma there. Okay, so you apply a vector field on a function, get a function. You apply another vector field on a function, get another function. So you can calculate the commutator of those things as well. And then the commutator between a lead derivative and an inner derivation is given by an inner derivation, which is curious because a lead derivative has actually derivatives in it, an inner derivation doesn't, right? But again, it's one of those cancellation things, and I will show you in a moment how they come about. So this is only to say that we use the fact that vector fields map zero forms into zero forms, and therefore we can concatenate them and calculate also commutators in between them. Yeah, actually, that's what I wanted to show you in detail now. Remember, I said that the commutator between two lead derivatives is a lead derivative, in spite of the fact that a lead derivative is a first derivative. Now, a lead derivative on a function is just the vector field, right? The directional derivative on a function is just the vector field. So let us look at the special case where the lead derivative is acting on functions, where we are dealing with the commutator of lead derivatives on a function, which is really just the commutator of two vector fields. Again, same argument as before, just specialized to functions. We have a vector field. This is consisting of partial derivatives. It is to say of first derivatives. The commutator between two such things, between two first derivatives, why is not that not a second derivative? Why does it happen to be a vector field again? The commutator between two vector fields is a vector field. Why? Well, let's apply the commutator of two vector fields onto a function. It is by definition the application of the first vector field eta on the function, and then the second vector field xi applied to the resulting function, minus the other way around. Explicitly, in a chart, this is the following. Xi is a linear combination of partial derivatives. So it is xi I d by d xi. That's this thing here, right? Xi sum over xi I d by d xi, this thing. And then here we have the eta I d by dxi. That's this directional derivative, this vector field. And it's applied to f minus the other way around. This term is that one. Now, when we work this thing out, we have this derivative acting on everything to the right. Okay, because we have, I mean, this acts on that function here. This first derivative acts on that function. Then we multiply with this coefficient function. And it's important that the vector field can be position dependent. So the eta is position dependent in general. So we obtain now, after we apply those derivatives on f, and then we multiply with those coefficient functions, we obtain a function again. Now we apply the second vector field to that. That derivative acts on everything here. In particular, it will not only act to provide the second derivative on f, it will also act to provide the first derivative on eta by the product rule. Now let's first look at the second derivative case. By the product rule, this thing will act on this, leaving the eta the same. And also it will produce a term where it acts on eta, leaving that the same. But let us look at the term where this acts on that, leaving the eta the same. There is a similar term arising over here, where this derivative doesn't act on the xi, it acts to provide a second derivative of f. And those two terms cancel each other. The second derivative term on this comes with the xi I eta j, and also here the second derivative comes with the xi I and eta j, or xi j eta I, doesn't matter. Since the partial derivatives commute, those two second derivative terms cancel each other. However, by the Leibniz rule, we also obtain terms where the eta gets differentiated here and where the xi gets differentiated there. Those two terms survive here. And overall, these are just coefficient functions. This is the eta differentiated in the direction of xi, and that's the xi j differentiated in the direction of the xi. Overall, we can call this thing here, which has only one index left over the j index, nu j, so that we can write the outcome of all this calculation as the sum over nu j coefficient functions times the partial derivative, just one partial derivative acting on f, which is to say this is a vector field again. So what we notice here is that indeed the commutator of two vector fields is a vector field. It's a special case of the observation that the commutator of two Lie derivatives, two general directional derivatives, is a directional derivative. And we see now what the reason for that is. The reason is that the coefficient functions in the vector field xi and in the vector field eta can be position dependent. And that is being picked up by the derivatives. If it weren't for that, the commutator would have to vanish, because partial derivatives commute with each other. So if you choose the coefficients xi I and eta I to be constant, commutator is zero. Okay, so we have defined directional derivatives now for functions, and we've defined it for differential forms. But is that good enough? Should we not also define directional derivatives for tensor fields that don't happen to be differential forms? Remember, differential forms are special tensor fields. They are purely covariant, and they are totally antisymmetric. But what about other tensor fields? Aren't there any other important tensor fields? Well, there are, of course. For example, as we will later see, the metric tensor. The metric tensor is going to be covariant, but not antisymmetric. We will need to calculate its directional derivative too. It's going to be extremely important, because whether or not that Lie derivative vanishes will determine whether via Noether's theorem we get a conservation law or not. We will need to find out whether or not the metric or the curvature of spacetime is constant in a particular direction. That will tell us whether in that direction we get a conservation law. So certainly we will need to extend the definition of the Lie derivative beyond the action of just differential forms, so that it can also act on all arbitrary tensors. For example, also on vectors. So far we can only have it act on covectors, but not on, I mean, only on cotangent vectors, not on tangent vectors. Another question that arises here is, can we express the Lie derivative as a Newton-Leibniz limit? Can we express it in coordinates, like an ordinary derivative, where the derivative of a function is given by this Newton-Leibniz limit? We can do that, and we can also generalize it to arbitrary tensors, and the two go hand in hand. So here's the geometric definition of the Lie derivative. Remember that for any path in the manifold, a path being a map from some interval of R, which you can think of as a time interval, into the manifold. So we have some variable that you may think of as a time variable, and it is mapped into points of the manifold. Now, for any such path, we have a tangent vector, and we denote the tangent vector to a path at a point gamma bar. So at the point that we arrive at time t equals t0, we will call the tangent vector gamma bar. And what does it do? Well, a tangent vector, the tangent vector at the point that we arrive at the time t equals 0, is mapping functions or function germs into the number that we get when we apply the tangent vector onto a function. It's the directional derivative. That was the geometric definition of a tangent vector. And what is it? It is, by the geometric definition of a tangent vector, the t derivative or time derivative of the function applied after the path. Remember, this is an element of R mapped into an element of the manifold, which is then mapped into R again. Remember, gamma of t is like a path you travel on the manifold. F of t was like the temperature on the manifold. And so F of gamma of t is the temperature function as you travel on the manifold. And d by dt of that is the rate of change of the temperature. Okay, so this is what a tangent vector does. It maps functions f into the rate of temperature change at a particular point. It was just a reminder. So think of paths now. Now imagine we're given a vector field xi. Then a path gamma in the manifold is called an integral curve of the vector field xi if the tangent vectors of that path happen to be locally the vectors of the vector field. See what I mean? So you have a vector field. You can visualize that in R2, for example. You can visualize that as at every point having some vector pointing in some direction. And you can ask, is there a path such that on that path, the tangent vector is always in agreement with the local tangent vector of the vector field? Right? So you're basically viewing the vector field as a velocity field. So we are saying that when we have a vector field, we interpret it as a velocity field. And a particular path that has those velocities is then called an integral curve. From the theory of ordinary differential equations, one can prove that on smooth manifolds, at every point P, there exists some neighborhood. Some neighborhood in which you always have such an integral curve, which is itself C infinity. This means that any such smooth vector field gives us a flow. Every vector field, not just in R2, but every vector field on a smooth manifold can be viewed as the velocity field of some flow. This could be a very non-trivial flow. For example, the flow might have divergence, in which case it means that fluid would have to either be compressed or decompressed or sucked out of the medium or pumped into it. The vector field could have a curl, in which case it could be rotational. But in any case, there always is some sort of fluid flow whose tangent vectors are the vectors of the vector field. That's not necessarily true globally, but there's always a patch around each point on which it is true. Let us not worry about the local versus global thing here. So in practice, let us visualize it. Here's our manifold M, and we have a vector field on it. You get to choose the vector field. Doesn't matter which one, it just has to be smooth. Then there is a flow, which is to say there is a bunch of curves which run through every point of the manifold, at least on that patch where it's valid, such that the tangents to those paths are tangent vectors of our vector field. Now let's say we follow that flow for a second or a microsecond or some fixed amount of time. Which means that, concretely, we can choose a point of the manifold, and now we follow the integral curve that goes through it for a second and see where we end up. We'll flow somewhere. So our point was mapped to another point. In the meantime, if we had started with this point, we would have flown over there. This point would have flown somewhere here, this point somewhere over there. So the entire manifold, or at least as far as it holds in a patch, the entire manifold gets mapped into itself. Every point flows to another point after a fixed amount of time. And it does so in a smooth way. Okay, so overall what we have is that we are mapping the manifold into itself. every point of the manifold, after a fixed amount of time, ends up on another point of the manifold. Every point has an image point. And let's call it phi t of p. Assuming that the manifold and the vector field are all smooth, this flow will give us a diffeomorphism. The flow for 1 second, let's say, or for 1 microsecond or whatever. It will give us a diffeomorphism. So all points of the manifold will have flown somewhere. There are two ways to look at that, by the way. There's an active and a passive way to look at it. We should really think of this here actively. We have points of the manifold and we map them into new points of the manifold, wherever they end up after they followed the flow a fixed amount of time. That we get to choose, and then once we've chosen the amount of time, we hold it fixed. But alternatively, you could also take a passive view. You could say that, well, this m here could be, I mean, it's a special case. The m could be Rn. This m could also be Rn. We could have a complicated manifold up there somewhere, and this is a chart for the manifold, and that's a chart for the manifold. Then this is simply a change of chart map. Special case. Okay, but it may be better to think of it for the moment as an active map where points of the manifold get mapped into points of the manifold through some diffeomorphism. And remember what that means. Whenever we have a differentiable manifold here and a differentiable manifold there, doesn't matter which they are, they can be the same or not the same. Remember that the diffeomorphism from left to right induces an algebra homomorphism from functions or function germs into function germs in this direction, and a tangent map that maps tangent vectors here into tangent vectors over there. You know, tangent vectors around the point here into tangent vectors around the point there. And more generally, cotangent vectors and tensors around that point get mapped into tensors around that point. So we see how the whole machinery that we developed earlier applies for this special case here too. At this point, it may be worth giving you some orientation where we are going with all of this. So that you don't forget. Remember, that's what we want to do. Okay? What we want to do is, we want to see the Lie derivative as something like that. And on differentiable manifolds, that's highly non-trivial. Because, well, let's look at it first for these functions according to Newton and Leibniz. What do we have to do? We take the function at the point x plus epsilon minus the function at the point x, divide by epsilon, take the limit epsilon going to 0. That's all good and fine because this thing is number valued. And here that is number valued too. And the difference between two numbers can be calculated easy. Take the limit. But on a differentiable manifold, if x is a point and x plus epsilon, so to speak, is a different point of the manifold, then what if f is a tensor field? Then this is a tensor in the tensor space at x, and this is a tensor in the tensor space at x at a different point, x plus epsilon. Or this could be a vector or a covector. This could be a cotangent vector in a cotangent space to x. This would be a cotangent vector in a cotangent space to x plus epsilon. But we can't subtract vectors that live in different vector spaces. Right? Can't subtract them from another. So how are we ever going to do this? This is where this picture comes in. Remember that when we have a diffeomorphism from a manifold into the manifold again, and this is going to be a little bit of a flow. We just flow epsilon. Okay? But at the moment, we don't have to keep it small, so it could be a large flow. The point is that whenever we move points a little bit further, like by epsilon or whatever, whenever we have a map from a manifold to a manifold, we also have a corresponding map from functions into functions and a map of tangent vectors into tangent vectors, cotangent vectors into cotangent vectors, tensors into tensors, tensors that live in that tensor space get mapped into tensors that live in that tensor space, and vice versa. Once we have established that map from those respective tensor spaces into each other, then we can take a tensor in that tensor space, map it over into this tensor space, take the difference between two tensors. Because they now live in the same tensor space, we can calculate the difference, divide by epsilon, take the limit, and so on. This is how we are going to define the Lie derivation, the Lie derivative. Okay, so as always, diffeomorphisms on manifolds induce corresponding isomorphisms of the tangent, cotangent, and all tensor spaces at the point P and at the point that we arrive at when we flow from P to the point phi tp. So phi index t is the flow for an amount of time t. And so phi t of p is the point that we arrive at a little later, this point. Okay? So this map over here is inducing a map from the tangent spaces over here to the tangent spaces over there, and the same for the tensor spaces. It's this map. We call it phi t star. It maps the tensors around the point P into tensors around the point phi t of P, and vice versa. It is invertible. Okay, so remember what the tensor field does. So now we're introducing a tensor field tau. It's the thing that we want to differentiate. This tensor field is not anything to do with integral curves.
Right, but previous.
Yes. Right. So remember how we defined this. We had the manifold. We defined. Sorry, I should take the picture earlier. So we have the manifold. We take a vector field on it. The vector field. The vector field defines the vector field psi defines for us a flow. And we follow that flow for an amount of time t, for amount of parameter value t. And that means that every point gets mapped into another point of the manifold. Now we pull this apart. And instead of drawing it all in one picture, we draw it in two. So now we have that the flow by an amount of time t maps all points, such as the point p, into other points, such as the point phi t of p. And now we choose a tensor field that we want to differentiate.
But whether there is a flow depends on whether the field you were originally talking about is continuous.
Yeah, we assume everything to be smooth. That's right. Only if the vector fields are smooth and the manifold is smooth can you guarantee that there is actually a flow. Right. And even then, only locally. So it's for a patch. Okay, so now let's introduce a tensor field tau that we will differentiate. For every point of the manifold, tau of p is some RS tensor, some R-fold contravariant, S-fold covariant tensor. So we assume this to be an RS tensor. R and S are arbitrary. Then we can already indicate what we mean by a tensor field being invariant under a flow. What it's supposed to mean is, so that it's constant under the flow, means that if we take the tensor field at the point P and compare that with the tensor field at the point phi t of P, which is where we flow to after a time t, then we should get the same thing. Of course, a priori, we cannot compare, because the tensor field at the later point lives in a different tensor space than the tensor field at the original point. However, we have this phi star map, which maps the two tensor spaces into each other. Right? Phi goes this way, and then there is this map between the algebra of functions, and then there's this map that maps tensor spaces into each other. Right? And that's the map we use to compare. So we are saying that a vector field, a tensor field stays constant, stays the same, if when evaluated at the point P, and then transported using the phi star map, the tensor isomorphism between the tensor spaces, over to the tensor space at the point phi t, we get the same tensor. Now that's only a definition of what it means that the tensor field doesn't change. But what's the rate of change if it does change? What's the derivative? Well, we can now define, and that will be a geometric definition, we can now define the Lie derivative of a tensor field tau at the point P, which is the starting point of a path before we flow a little bit away. So the Lie derivative of a tensor field tau at a point P with respect to the flow induced by a vector field psi, so in the direction of the vector field psi, is defined in this way. The Lie derivative in the direction of the vector field psi of a tensor tau is by definition, just like Newton and Leibniz, limit t going to 0, 1 over t, and this is the tensor at the faraway point where we flowed to, minus the tensor where we are at the point P. But the tensor at the faraway point has to be transported using the phi star map into the tensor space where we are at the point P. So to spell it out more precisely, it's the limit for t going to 0, 1 over t. Then it's the tensor at the point P, therefore living in the tensor space at the point P. And this is being subtracted from the tensor at the further away point, you know, it's like the x plus epsilon point, at the faraway point, and it is exactly the following. You take the flow, gamma of t, so you're flowing 4 time t along the integral curve to the vector field to another point. At this other point, gamma of t, you're evaluating what the tensor field is. Now that quantity lives in the tensor space at this faraway point. And then you use the phi star map to map that into the tensor space at the point P. Now you can compare it with this one because those two tensors live in the same vector space, they live in the same tensor space. And then you take 1 over t, let t go to 0. So you let the amount of flow time go to 0. And then you get a Newton-Leibniz limit. I guess you start appreciating the simplicity of the algebraic definitions, right? It's going to get worse if you do it in a chart now. But you have to see it in a chart as well, at least once. So imagine we have a map phi now, which maps our points into the points where they flow to after the amount of time t. So a point that is sitting at coordinates x moves to the point with coordinates x tilde. You can think of this actively and passively, as we said, right? So let's say it's just an infinitesimal flow. So this is a physicist's way of arguing, working in a chart and expanding things in Taylor expansions. All right, so the flow takes points from positions x to positions x tilde, and it's an infinitesimal flow, which means that the new coordinates of the point after it has flown a little bit are the old coordinates plus a small amount of time t times the direction vector in which we were flowing, plus higher order stuff, which is quadratic in t and higher powers. Okay, so the change of coordinates is given by the vector field locally. That means that the change of coordinates matrix, the Jacobian, dx tilde by dx, can be calculated explicitly now. Simply differentiate that with respect to x. You get a Kronecker delta over here. That's this one. And you get the derivative of the psi, the direction vector with respect to x. That's this matrix, and everything else is higher order in t. from now on, we will use a simplifying notation. A notation that I think, I'm not sure whether Einstein has used that. Well, in any case, it's a very common notation in differential geometry. Instead of saying d by dxj, we will simply put a comma there, comma j. Okay, so instead of writing dxi by dxj, we will write xi I and then comma j. Comma j means partial derivative in the direction of xj. That will simplify the equations a little bit. Yeah, there's a bug. Okay. Right, now the inverse matrix to this, by the way, is just the same except for a minus sign over here. Please try this out. Take that matrix, multiply it onto that matrix, keep only terms that are up to linear in T, and check that this is really the inverse to that. Okay, then what's the image of our tensor as we let it flow? Under the flow, backwards. So we go from a point x to a point x tilde under the flow. There we evaluate the tensor, map it back to the original point, subtract from what the tensor was at that point, and then we divide by the distance, by the amount of flow, that gives us the Leibniz rule, that gives us the Newton-Leibniz limit of the derivative. So here we take the tensor at the faraway point, I mean not that far away, just, you know, infinitesimally far away point. And we have to map it back under the flow. Under the flow that took x to x tilde, now we have to map the tensor from what it is at x tilde into what it is at x. And explicitly, this is the following. So here's the tensor tau evaluated at the point x tilde. And it has plenty of indices. This map, the phi star inverse, takes us back to the original point where we were before the flow happened. So that's the tensor at the later point. And in order to rewrite it in terms of the x, we have to use all those Jacobian factors, as we can easily see when we adopt the passive point of view. But now the tensor is still a function of the x tilde. Let us write it as a function of the x. So it becomes x plus t xi, well, plus stuff of order t squared. Those Jacobian matrices take that form. Remember, we just had that up here. These are the Jacobian matrices of change of variables, just those. We need those for the contravariant and these for the covariant indices. So we obtain here tau at the faraway point, and here we have the Jacobian matrices. Now finally, to evaluate the whole thing in terms of the x, because we have to evaluate at the point x, which is where we are before we do the flow, we have to Taylor expand this thing, the tensor. How much does it change as it flows? Well, it's the tensor at x plus tau times the derivative of the tensor, and then contracted with the coefficients of the vector xi. So that's here. This expression here is the tensor at x plus t times the derivative of the tensor. That's what the comma means. Comma k means d by dxk. And then contracted with the components of the direction vector xi, that's xi k. Just to remind you, a function, comma k, is d by dx k f. And then I spelled out what these things are, dropping all the terms that are of second or higher power in t. Then we just obtain this. And the structure of it is the following. We obtain that when we look at the tensor in the faraway point and express it in the tensor space at the near point P, where we start out before the flow, we obtain that it is the tensor that we started out with plus T times the derivative of the coefficient functions of the tensor, comma k, contracted with the direction vector xi, minus, and then we get the tensor again, but not differentiated. Instead, it's the direction vector that is differentiated. That arose from this here. You see, dx tilde by dx produces derivatives of the direction vectors over here. All right, so we get plenty of terms of that kind where we have derivatives of the direction vectors, and we get terms with minus signs, and we get terms with plus signs for covariant and contravariant indices of our tensor tau, respectively. And now we can explicitly write out what the Lie derivative of our tensor is. The Lie derivative of the tensor is given by the limit t going to 0, 1 over t, the tensor at the faraway point mapped into the tensor space where we start out before the flow, minus what the tensor is at that original point. And that is given by this expression, which is exactly what we had before, except that this term goes away because we subtracted. That's what the tensor was before it was flowing. And the factors of t go away because of the 1 over t in the Newton-Leibniz formula, this one. So we are just left with these terms. Again, the structure of it is this. The Lie derivative of a tensor in the direction of xi is given by a leading term where we differentiate the tensor coefficients and contract with the direction vector. This is what we would do if tau were just a function. We differentiate the function, and then we contract with the coefficients of the direction vector. But for a tensor, it gets a little more complicated, because we also get terms where we have the tensor unchanged, and we contract it with partial derivatives of the direction vector. And the index structure that we contract with matches covariant or contravariant indices. It's automatic. There's only one way to do it for covariant and for contravariant ones. Just have to keep in mind the minus signs for the covariant ones and the plus ones for the contravariant ones. All right. See, that's all very tedious, and clearly we don't want to do that all the time in coordinates. That's why it is so useful to have general properties and algebraic definitions and so on. Yes?
I hope you're not going to stay at the moment. I don't want to have to head.
Okay.
In the definition, the algebraic definition for the correlate, the derivative in the correlate predefinition.
Yeah.
So we had a phi star there.
Mm-hmm.
Comes from the vector field.
Yeah.
So
yes.
Phi star is somehow specified by the vector field.
That's right.
How? Can we say something about it?
Yeah. Remember that the vector field defines a flow, right? It defines a bunch of paths. So every point in the manifold, there's a path. Okay? And the path is such that the tangents along the path agree with the vectors of the vector field. Okay? So now you have a flow, and phi is simply that flow. So the phi and the xi have exactly the same information content.
So the map between the two tangent spaces is
induced by that phi.
So it's induced in a way which is straightforward. It just transforms parallel to the vector.
Oh, no, it's not. No. Remember that, yeah. You're anticipating metrics, affine connections, and so on. We don't have metrics and affine connections, so we cannot have parallel transport. There is no such thing as parallel transport just yet, right? Remember that when we have this, we have a vector field, and there are integral curves to the vector field. They define a flow. And the flow you could follow for, let's say, a second or 5 seconds, which means that points are really flowing far away. Okay. And then there will be a map of points into points functions into functions, tensor spaces into tensor spaces. And that map of tangent spaces into tangent spaces is entirely induced by the map of functions into functions, which is induced by that map of points into points. It's entirely induced by that. There is no notion of parallel transport in this.
How a vector field induces a flow and uses this diffeomorphism between the. I can visualize that. But how do I visualize the map between two tangent spaces that
well, let's remember how it is defined. The best you can do is, you know, realize exactly what the definition is. So when you have a map of points into points, then that will induce a map of functions into functions. If you have a function here on the manifold, that will turn into a function over there by concatenating it with our diffeomorphism, right? And so you have a map of functions into functions. Now, tangent vectors are directional derivatives on functions. So they then are mapped from here to here, simply in this way that if you have a tangent vector over here, it maps, it feeds on functions. But a function here can be mapped into a function over there by concatenation with that map. So tangent vectors have an induced map because the functions have an induced map, induced through the set of points there. And you can view it both passively and actively. These can be two charts if you want, but it can also be viewed as one and the same manifold. Okay, so after having gone through all this messy business here, let's see, is this really equivalent to the algebraic definition of the Lie derivative in the direction psi? Well, yes, it is. Let us check that the action on functions and the action on one forms agrees at least. So let's say tau is a function, so it's a zero, zero tensor. It's just a function. Then it doesn't carry any indices. It's just a function. The Lie derivative of that function is now given by the formula above, only by the first term. Remember, the Lie derivative in general is given in this way. We have a partial derivative of the tensor contracted with the coefficients of the direction vector in which we, for the direction in which we want to differentiate. That's this. We take the partial derivative of the tensor, in our case a 0,0 tensor, and contract it with the direction vector in which we want to differentiate. And then we get additional terms with minus signs and with plus signs, which arise when we have covariant and contravariant indices. In this case, we have to differentiate also the direction vectors. But none of those terms arise because our tensor in this special case is 0,0. It's a 0,0 tensor. So what we obtained is simply this, you know, psi k tau comma k is this, which is simply the directional derivative of tau of a function. And that's how we define the Lie derivative on zero forms. So it agrees with how we defined the Lie derivative earlier algebraically. Now, for a covector field for one forms, let's go through this as well. So now our one form is the linear combination of those basis vectors here. And the Lie derivative of our one form is now given by the partial derivative of the coefficient function contracted with the direction vector. That's by the general rule, this is this term again, partial derivative of the tensor contracted with the directional vector. And then we also have this type of term because it's a one vector. Actually, it's a plus sign. Sorry, I mixed that up. So we also have that term here where we leave the tensor invariant and then we contract with the partial derivative of the direction vector. And I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that this is exactly also the formula that we obtained earlier. It's just one or two lines. And that agrees with the formula that we had algebraically. Now let us quickly, before we finish this lecture, collect the properties. The Lie derivative of RS tensors of an RS tensor is an RS tensor again. Remember that the benefit we obtained by going all the way with the Newton-Leibniz definition is that we have now Lie derivatives acting on arbitrary tensors, not just differential form. An important property one can now prove is that the Lie derivative of a tangent vector field is mapping a tangent vector field, so not a one form, but a tangent vector field, not a cotangent vector field, is mapping a tangent vector field into the Lie derivative of the tangent vector field, which happens to be the commutator. The commutator between two vector fields is the Lie derivative of the one of the other. And one also finds that the Lie derivative is linear in its arguments down here. The Lie derivative of the commutator of two vector fields is the commutator of the two Lie derivatives of the vector fields. And finally, it turns out that the Lie derivative also obeys a Leibniz rule. Now it can't, I mean, the general Lie derivative on all tensors also obeys a Leibniz rule. It can't obey a Leibniz rule for wedge products because general tensors don't have a wedge product. Only covariant, totally anti-symmetric tensors. Only the differential forms have a wedge product. But it turns out that the Lie derivative obeys a Leibniz rule for the tensor product. So the Lie derivative of the tensor product of two tensors is the Lie derivative of the one, leaving the second invariant, plus vice versa. And indeed, tensors form an algebra with respect to multiplication. The Lie derivative really is a derivation again. And we could have introduced it algebraically too, but at some point it's useful to also see stuff in coordinates. Okay, that's it for this lecture. Sorry, I went a bit over time again. Let's have a break.